You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey, gang. Thanks for joining us at Marriage Therapy Radio. I'm here with Laura. We have a special guest today, mostly because of a question we got from a listener. I'm going to play that question for you right now. And then we'll hear from Bob Navarro, who is one of my favorite therapists in the Gottman Network and who is brilliant in the area of addiction and recovery.
Hi, Zach and Laura. I was just wondering if you have any episodes where you talk about alcohol abuse, and how that affects the marriage and how you can move forward with good communication when there might be some alcohol abuse involved. Thank you. Bye.
So, yeah, there you have it. Here comes Bob Navarro. Stick around. Hey, everybody. So this is it. We're here with Laura, who's always...
I'm here.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah.
You've been on the road and moving across the world and all that stuff.
But it's been bonkers. It really has been.
And we're here together with Bob Navarro, who is a therapist out of, what is it, Santa Monica?
No, San Carlos, California.
San Carlos, California.
You're in the right state.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are? Because we obviously know you, but our people don't.
Okay. I'm sorry, Zach, but that's confidential. I can't say any information. Yeah. Oh, this is about me. I guess I can do that. All right. Yeah, so I'm a therapist, certified Gottman therapist, master trainer. I'm in that category. And I specialize in working in addiction treatment. And I've been doing this a long time. I've been in practice for 35 years, actually.
That's insane.
It is insane. It is. And the last...
I was listening to Ray Romano on a comedy set the other day, and he was back in the club that he kind of grew up in, and he was talking to the audience, and he was like, I have been working in this club longer than you've been alive. Like, I've been doing this stuff, this comedy gig in this space. It was really fascinating to hear him... put some perspective on it like that.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah. Hey, I have a question, Bob, because I don't know this, but what got you into working in addiction recovery and working with couples? Was it like which came first, or did you evolve into addiction?
It evolved, actually. I was in practice for about 5 years, and I looked at my practice and saw literally, I remember this quite literally, not figuratively, but this was the number. 80% of my clients had some alcohol or drug related issue or concern.
Huh.
And I was not prepared to deal with it. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So that's when I sort of said, well, this is an area I wasn't originally interested in, to be honest with you, but here it is. So I got some training and got addicted to addiction. Learn what it is and how
What's
you can
like?
Work with it.
Is that good?
I think that's
being addicted.
Yeah, because it's hard to get therapists involved in addiction treatment. It's hard to get couples and individuals into treatment because of the stigma usually attached with it.
Yeah.
Well, you just threw out an interesting number. Well, first, let me back up and just tell our listeners that the reason why we originally wanted to have you on, Bob, is that we've had so many requests from listeners who have written in with lots of questions. And so I wanted to let our listeners know this is the direction that we're going, is we're going to be talking about addiction and recovery. We're going to be taking a lot of questions that we've received over the last 2 years.
Yeah.
What would you say? You said 80% of your practice now 30 years ago was what you were seeing. What percentage do you think, either just anecdotally or maybe you know the research,
anecdotally? Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure that I'll go with what you say, Zach.
Yeah. But what percentage of couples are experiencing either drug or alcohol use, misuse, that's affecting the relationship in some way?
That's an interesting question, because it's probably more than the statistics indicate, which seem to point towards 2/3 of all American families have been impacted by addiction.
Wow.
2/3. So you look at, 3 out of 4 people walking in your office probably have had some impact
yeah.
from various degrees, from little to a lot.
And it's probably true too, that, that people don't really tell the truth about their drinking.
That's also true. That's true.
Yeah.
So one thing that's cool about Bob is that wrote a curriculum that helps train clinicians deal with these issues in their office. And I don't like most of who is listening is not quite clinicians. They're actual couples that are dealing with stuff. And so while I do want to hear from your kind of your collected wisdom, I also want to know just kind of what gets you excited. You know, just imagine that the three of us are sitting around at a pub, just, well, maybe not a pub, but
taking a walk in the sun.
Yeah. And just talking about kind of what you're seeing, what you're thinking. I mean, again, we'll ask some questions, but what is it that kind of wakes you up when you think about actually being of help to couples in this space?
Well, you know, the first workshop I wrote actually in this area was for couples. And it's called Roadmap to the Journey, which I'm currently actually sort of re-implemented. And it's a 2-day retreat for couples in recovery. So what I think about is that there are very little resources for individuals or couples that are interested in addressing relationship issues. And so there's not a standard yet in the field that says this is a good thing to do. And what I'm hoping to do is change that standard. So we're moving from an individually only focus to a couple focus that says, well, let's look at the relationship. And that's what really gets my motor running is this advocacy piece. And I'm very excited about the results.
So let me ask you this question of, the traditional model is that if somebody goes into recovery or they're seeking help in some way, it's a very individualistic process. They're either doing like an out treatment or, in treatment, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so what makes it different when you're treating the couple? What is it about Roadmap for the Journey, or I guess the vision of treating couples together, that has a greater impact or it can change the process?
There was some research that came out a while ago by Humphrey Moos and Cohen that looked at the single biggest predictor for successful outcomes in addiction or alcohol treatment that was limited to alcohol in this particular study, is the relationship satisfaction with the partner, not just generic social relationships that was in there, but the single biggest predictor was relationship stability and satisfaction. So for some reason, we haven't sort of incorporated that into our current treatment approaches to say, instead, you need to work on your individual stuff until you're stable in your individual recovery. Then we can work on your relationship, which is typically too late for many couples who have the highest divorce rate.
Does that okay? So that's within the context of a marriage, right? It, like, so if I'm a single guy, or if I'm just a single parent or something, and I'm not married, mm-hmm. does the notion of being in a satisfying relationship still contribute to, you know, recovery success? Or does the study you're talking about pretty much limited to marriage?
It was limited to marriage.
Yeah. So it's not like,
but you know, it's not a stretch, right? To say, you know, if you've got a stable relationship in your life and you're feeling pretty good in it, then obviously the odds of increased sobriety over time increase. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. I wonder if that's why, like, the kind of the sponsor model works in AA, like that there's some sense of a,
community
or just a stable relationship, or at least with one person who's really committed to being being gracious and just and kind, and I don't know,
empathetic, and yeah.
And you know, I think the other part that the research doesn't really get to that I think is really crucial is that the emphasis typically is on the sobriety outcomes, which it's a good study, right? So from that perspective, that's helpful. But really what my approach is beyond sobriety. It's like looking at what each individual needs for their own health and recovery and what the relationship needs. Because the partner of somebody who's really struggling with a substance or a compulsive behavior has been traumatized, and now if their partner's in recovery, it's sort of, well, what about me? And my approach includes, what about you? Let's talk about you and the impact of this on both of you and on your relationship.
I remember you said, I took your workshop twice, I think. And I remember you saying that addiction is really hard for couples, but recovery can be harder.
Yeah, that's right. There's a whole new set of problems. The thing that it's interesting is that typically doesn't occur is this notion of the trauma of recovery. Those words tend not to go together. The trauma of addiction go together intuitively.
Right.
Oh, yeah. But the trauma of recovery means, okay, now we have, we're in a whole new relationship, basically. And we don't know what to expect or how to operate together. That's what needs attention.
So I'm curious, what does that look like if a couple was seeking recovery together? Mm-hmm. And I know that you mentioned that this is a weekend workshop, but then what about something that's longer term? Do you have a model that you use where you take a couple in, and maybe are you working with each partner individually and then also together in couples therapy?
No. Typically, I work just with the couple and encourage them to find their individual support if they don't have that. And so the notion is, honestly, this is like recovery anarchy 101, because what I encourage couples to do with the right structure is often discouraged, I have to say. One is, if you want your partner to know something about your recovery because it's important to you, you can ask or tell your partner. If you have questions about your partner's recovery because you don't understand, you can ask. Is there a structure to talk about the impact of recovery? Have we ever talked about that as a couple? I think they ought to be doing that. So those are three rules that typically are not encouraged in individual support programs.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I must be lucky, because the only training that I have received is your training. So I have your version in my head rather than the other versions. I have a question for you that came in from our listeners. What do you do when one partner is unwilling to seek help and the other partner is really encouraging them to seek help? And probably it's going to be the person dragging their feet is the one who has misuse or issues around alcohol or substance use, whatever it might be. So what do you do? That's a listener question.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And I want to reframe it just for a second, because the experience I'm having is that it's not a partner encouraging someone to seek help. It's almost like them demanding or requiring that they seek help. It's not necessarily gentle love. It's more like this exasperated, exasperated mm-hmm. exasperation. It's the dark kind.
Yes. Yeah. Followed quickly by despair and fear and hopelessness, right?
That's true.
The trio there. So I'm thinking it actually does work both ways, though. Because I'll try to answer the question. For the person actually in recovery, sometimes their partner isn't, meaning person in recovery from an addictive disorder of some kind, whether it's a behavioral or a substance. Sometimes like they get it. It's like, wow, I need to really change my life and how we do things. And the partner saying, hey, this is your problem. I'm not the one that's drinking or using coke or whatever. And it's not mm-hmm. seen as a relationship issue. Right. Mm. So I'm thinking in either case, it's important for the partner who's concerned to say something like, when I see this or these experiences, and then kind of name specifically, you know, when you came home late last night, you said you'd be home at 10 and it was midnight, past midnight. You know, I really worry. I struggle with the impact that alcohol is having on you and on me. And I would like it if we could do something about it. And then the partner says, I don't have a problem. Then
you're overreacting. You're
right. There's that, you know, I'm not your alcoholic father. Then all the things in the defensive reactions can kick in. So the bind I know for the partner in those circumstances to say, well, I can't force you, but doesn't mean I have to be silent either. And I can't nag you into this. Mm-hmm. I think optimally all you can do is say, once again, I'm hurt by a concern. I'm angry. I'm frustrated. I'm just letting you know. And so that it doesn't go underground, you know, that you know, when issues go underground and we can't talk about it or name it, even maybe we can't talk about it, but if I can't even name it, then that feels like it has power. I think that I worry about.
Yeah. Boy, I really like the idea, because oftentimes we find that there's really just one partner that wants to seek help. And this is just in general in our practice that when people come to see us, I like to ask which one of you made the appointment and which one of you is just showing up for your partner because they asked. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea that you're coming together and you're saying, we're doing this together. This is our journey that we are taking on together. And I think that that can really help. That you said there's a stigma in seeking help and cutting that stigma down, which is something I'm really trying to fight against as a therapist, is breaking the stigma of people seeking help. I like that.
Well, you know, I just actually gave the Roadmap Retreat at Hazelden and Betty Ford a couple of weeks ago. So this is the Minnesota mothership version, right? And so I was talking with Paul Anderson, the director.
You hear that, folks? We got the big time.
I know. I'm like really impressed.
Well, I'm impressed that I was invited.
Oh, so invited, even better.
They didn't even have to like go seeking out of
for once. Knock, 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 knock. You know, the treatment programs are not necessarily responding or even returning my phone calls. Hey, that's something I want to suggest you think about. But the thing is, I was talking with Paul Anderson, who's the director of that program. As a renewal center at my Hazelden campus, right? And he said something like this, you know, it's been 5-7 years since we've had any couple anything. And so he initiated this saying, you know what, this is really important work. And he sat in for most of the workshop. Thank you, Paul. I love you, Paul. And he said, wow, why we are not doing this. So this is something that needs attention. And it's what's interesting to me is that when I actually say, here's what happens in a workshop like this, oftentimes couples and therapists will go, oh, we're not doing this. Why? And I go, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, that's great. So there, are they planning on adopting your format, or are they just thinking, okay, the research is important. We need to be doing involving couples in recovery. What's their plan?
Well, I don't know their plan. I invited to go back actually Valentine's Day weekend, however you say that. How do I say that, Zach? Because you know how to say
Valentine's Day weekend.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, so there. So I'll be back for that weekend. However, I'm collaborating with Santa Clara University and with Butler Research at Hazelden to begin some research that will be reviewed by Butler that might then open the door to Hazelden and other treatment programs to kind of say, what's the before and after? Mm-hmm. So the structure of this is to give them pretest about relationship satisfaction and some of the stuff that we do as Gottman therapists, do the workshop 2 weeks after that, give the follow-up questionnaires, and then 2 months after that, do the follow-up and see if there's a connection between anything.
Awesome. Looking at efficacy or I love that.
Yeah.
I have a question. In terms of, we're talking a lot about couples that are in recovery, but if again, we're talking about couples that are still trying to kind of crack the code or curb use, and maybe it's one of them, both of them, who knows, I feel like I heard you say one time, you can't really do couples work when one of the people is still struggling with addiction or abuse. Does that sound right? Or am I?
No, that sounds totally wrong. Addiction. You said that you're confusing me with an imposter. No, I think it's just the opposite. I think that couples work, actually, in the research, it's been found to be more effective to move people into recovery than individual work. Why is that? Because we have partners in a structure to kind of say, so you found the vodka bottle behind the toilet. Let's talk about that. That I might not have heard from the person who left the vodka bottle behind the toilet. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with the stages of change, we start with this, I don't have a problem, to, all right, maybe there's something there too. Well, if I do have a problem, what could I do about it? To, now I'm ready to do something about it, and I'm ready to maintain that. So it's a process that is actually facilitated with the couple's work.
Wow. What would you recommend? So if our listeners are listening to this podcast and they're thinking, maybe it's time to see someone, what do they need to be looking out for? Because we oftentimes will tell our listeners, if you're having relationship issues, do not go to a generalist, go to somebody who is highly specialized as a couples therapist. So what should our listeners be looking for when they're seeking help and they're ready to take that next step, knowing that there is some active addiction or recovery or whatever they're looking for? What do they need to be looking out for?
Here's why I'm laughing. And I shouldn't laugh because this is probably going to sound really bad, but I think most therapists are really undertrained in this.
Absolutely.
And don't know what to look for or how to help couples sort this through. So, so if you can find an addiction specialist, that would be good. There are, as you know, listservs that put down people's specialties. And if they're listing addiction legitimately, then they would have a sense about when to be concerned. Because here's what we've learned. Because here's the thing that kind of blew my mind when this statistic came out a couple of years ago. So most people with a substance issue actually don't have an addiction. Most people with a substance-related problem don't even meet the criteria for a use disorder, but it's problematic. So there's that problematic area. Then there is an actual use disorder, which means you're meeting criteria to be diagnosed with mild, moderate, or severe of from whatever substance. Then at the severe end, you probably have an addiction. That's different than a use disorder. And this is what blew my mind. So I'm eventually getting to the point. 70% of people who are diagnosed with alcohol use disorder today will not meet that diagnosis in 4 years. So I thought, wait a minute, I thought alcoholism is indelible, like you're stuck in it. Turns out, no, they're just misusing alcohol. It has not followed into this addiction pattern where the brain circuitry is involved. So in my assessment, I'm trying to figure out of couples, individuals with substance issues or behavior problems like, you know, sexual dysregulation or gambling, whatever, is to try to figure out, well, where on the continuum do you fall? So it's problematic. So education could be enough to help people figure out, okay, so I'm drinking at risk levels. So what therapists can do, and I realize this is not for therapists, but I'll say it anyway, is to use the audit, the AUDIT. And that's a screening. It's a 10-item questionnaire. It's non-proprietary, developed by the World Health Organization. And look at the scores. And there's a free manual you can get to determine kind of on this continuum where people fall. And then the intervention or the approach is going to be based on, is it a use disorder? Is it an addiction? So hopefully sort of on the ground therapists can just be aware of that continuum and when to refer.
The audit though, it probably again presumes that people are going to tell you the truth or tell the assessment the truth.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
The hardest part. Yeah, I mean, I mean, again, I just think it's funny. You know, when we do our individual sessions, sometimes we'll say, "So, how much do you drink?" And they'll say, "Oh, I drink 3 or 4, nights a week, kind of couple beers." You know, so that's maybe 6, right? And then you ask the spouse, "How much does your partner drink?" And they'll go, "Oh, probably 6 beers, 5 nights a week." You know, and it's always this like sort of gap. There's always a gap, isn't there?
And that's why it's so cool to have the couple in the room saying, okay, you have different perspectives. So let's talk what they are and what would it mean to you if.
Yeah.
I think if you do nothing other than just have a conversation about the impact of this thing and the differences people have in their perspective, it takes it out of the shadows, so to speak, and puts it present. And, you know, the other thing I've learned too is that people aren't necessarily lying or defensive about their drinking necessarily. That isn't always the case. And I've had a number of people, when I say, well, here's the safe levels of drinking as science seems to point to right now, they go, oh, well, I'm way over that. And that, with that comes, you know, potential harm. And then they moderate their drinking so they can actually control it if they're on that end of the continuum where they can do that. If they're in the addiction phase, yeah, not so much.
What if there was an easy way to achieve connection without having to do a ton of work? What if you could make just a few small changes that helped you feel more alive, awake, and aware? Well, we're convinced that there is and that you can, because we have worked with hundreds of couples. We've pored over reams of research. We've even experienced change in our own marriages. And time again, if we have learned anything, it's this. You do not have to stay stuck. That is why we created Marriage in Motion. It's a video series for couples, 16 videos with corresponding activity sheets, because we want for you to take the information and the research that we have pored over and put it into action in your own relationship. Marriage for Motion is available now. Go to 4better.us, and for less than $300, you get the entire video series for a lifetime. We also have a guarantee that if you don't experience small changes in your relationship that have a big impact, we'll give you your money back. Check it out at 4better.us. We'd love for you to try the Marriage in Motion video series for couples.
Let me ask you this, Bob. There's a book that I often will recommend to clients, and you might be familiar with it. It's called Almost Alcoholic. Do you know this book?
I don't know the book.
It's these two guys out of Princeton. And basically what they did was they kind of began to define this range that they were calling almost. Yeah. And on the left, there was what's called normal social drinking. Yeah. And on the right was sort of diagnosed alcoholism. And then most people fall in this gigantic gray area in between, yeah, which may be the sort of thing that you're talking about. And their basic premise is that no matter where you are on in the giant gray area, your responsibility is to move left. That's kind of the theme of the book, is how do you move left, yeah, toward normal social drinking? And it seems like that has often given some hope to some of my clients, because they don't have to bear the kind of stigma of, is it too much, or is it too much because my husband says it's too much, or is it too much because science says it's too much? I can always move left. Moving left is always good.
Yeah.
A good choice to make. Is that kind of what you're describing?
It is. Actually, I have a series of slides in the training called Almost Alcoholic. And maybe I got it from that. I didn't read the book, but it's the concepts that have to do with misuse of alcohol. And, you know, we look at the increase of alcohol-related deaths have increased by 40% in the last decade, if not more. And it isn't because people are addicted. It's because they're drinking too much. Mm-hmm. Most people die from alcohol use, not because they're addicted, but because of the medical consequences that we're now discovering. 200 medical conditions associated with alcohol use. Even at so-called safe levels, it could be problematic.
Yeah. Hmm. I have a question before it falls out of my head. We were talking, Bob, you had said about just having a dialogue with your partner, and we're big fans of open-ended questions as Gottman certified therapists, but what would be some open-ended questions that our listeners could have if they're driving in the car on a road trip, or they're with their partner cooking dinner? What would be great open-ended questions to just open this up as a dialogue in their household about their use or misuse or impact on the relationship, that could just get the conversation started?
Okay. One would be, what's wrong with you? That's going to be in your head, but that's not what you should say. That comes out of your lips.
Why are you drinking Listerine? This is so weird.
Yeah. When is this going to stop? What is it going to take? So those are the thoughts that partners often have when there's concerns, right? So the open-ended questions you want to get to are probably starting with your, I guess, I mean, every couple is going to be different, I imagine, but it starts with, you know, here's my perspective. Alcohol seems to be filtering into our relationship and I'm worried about it. Here we go. I got to give you three good questions. And this is actually part of the training I do with therapists, but partners can ask the same questions. Like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you about your drinking? 10 being the most, 1 being not at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hope this doesn't sound like being a therapist, but how concerned are you?
I love that question. In fact, when a couple comes in and somebody says, I'm really worried about her drinking and da-da-da-da, and she da-da-da-da, or he, whatever, I will usually turn to him and go, are you worried about your drinking? Are you concerned about your, like how should, because I never want to just pile on with the complainer. I want to make sure that there's some sort of mutual place to begin. And if the person who's got the use issue isn't concerned, then you have to kind of get underneath that, right?
Well, and to get underneath that, a really good follow-up question is, if you do the 1 to 10 thing, some version of it's like, well, what person says, 3. They didn't say 1. Maybe they'll say 3. So what puts it at 3?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what would it take to bump it up to 5 or 6?
Or down to 2.
Or the other way. So you kind of, if you don't want to do that sort of the 1 to 10 thing, if it feels too awkward or something, you just say
too clinical.
Yeah. When are you are there times when you're concerned? When have you been concerned? If you've been concerned.
Mm-hmm. I like that. One question that I wrote down as I was thinking, I put you on the spot, so I probably should have given you my question first, is do you think that our relationship is negatively impacted by one or both of our use or whatever it might be? How do you think our relationship is impacted by our substance use? And I think that might be an interesting conversation. I've had a lot of couples that have said, we love it. Some couples will say we love to get stoned and have sex because it makes us, it feel better. I mean, we have a better relationship because of it. Mm-hmm. Or some person might say, you know, when you take a muscle relaxer on a Friday night, you are totally numb to me. And I absolutely hate that you are not present for me or for our kids or whatever it might be. But I think that's a great question to start off with, is how is our relationship impacted by our use?
Yeah. Negatively and positively.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a question treatment programs actually ask. Oftentimes they'll have people write out scenarios like, what are the positive aspects of using? What are the negative aspects?
Yeah. Yeah. I have another question that came up. This is taking us in a little bit of a different road, but it's more specific to clients and also to people who have written in, which is the boundaries that you play as having adult children who are negatively impacted with their journey, if there is a journey. But there seems to be, especially with some clients that I have seen, it's very difficult to create a healthy boundary between mom and dad and an adult child who might be addicted to meth or heroin or cocaine or whatever it might be. Do you have any support or any guidance that you might be able to give to parents who are struggling with their adult children?
Oh, okay.
So it's off because you're a couples therapist.
Well, yeah, but you know, I always think family-wise, relationship-wise, you know, yeah. So all of that is important to address. And I think you have to kind of look at resources. I think, you know, one option for if parents are really concerned about their adult children would be to consider doing an intervention. Mm-hmm. And interventions are not the kind like blindsiding people and having them step into a room of family and then feel like, oh my God, what did I step into? I'm not talking about that kind of intervention. There's interventions that have sort of evolved into much more, I would kind of say, humane or relationally oriented. So the technical term would be something like systemic family interventions. And what that means are versions of an educator who sits with the family and gets their concerns and addresses the issues for everybody, not just the person with the substance. So it's kind of like a workshop-y thing. And then people make commitments if they feel ready to do so to change their own life.
Mm. Yeah.
So systemic family interventions are one option. Mm-hmm. And another option would be sort of less intensively would be just to do what I suggested earlier, is to express concern. Mm-hmm. And, you know, have you considered what would it take? Is there any way we can support you in moving towards help? Mm-hmm. And then here's the hard part is, you know, this is not a term I particularly like, but the so-called codependent enabling concept
is
stepping back from allowing the addiction to go unchecked because you're not taking away the consequences. So it's really, really, really hard for parents who are concerned and love their adult children to not try to fix them.
I want to know why you don't particularly like that term codependent, because it's so ingrained in kind of the cultural vernacular.
It is.
People want to go, well, of course I'm codependent, but free them from that, or rather provide some perspective that maybe would help relax that stigma.
I'm really glad you asked me that question, because that's the other thing. Well, we're changing language about addiction. And so if I'm writing an article or an abstract or something, the language for addiction is stay away from the word alcoholic, substance abuser, substance abuse, and use alcohol use disorder, substance use disorder. So language communicates a lot. So if somebody's in a relationship with a partner who has a substance issue, we automatically, it seems, assign them this label of codependent. And that means there's something wrong and sick about your behavior. And I think it could pathologize people in a way that's not that helpful. So a term I want to add is an emerging term I'm starting to see is secondhand harm. All that means is I've been impacted by my partner's use of whatever, and there's negative consequences. And it's not because I'm a pathological person that's drawn to this. It's because addiction creates bad consequences for partners. Mm-hmm. So secondhand harm. And honestly, I also talk about the likelihood even of post-traumatic stress disorder. So when the partners, let's see, their addicted partner didn't get home by 10 o'clock p.m. when they said they would be after their meeting, and the partner at home floods with all this anxiety and worry, I don't think that's codependent. I think that's post-traumatic stress. Same thing. Mm-hmm. I've been lied to before. This feels really familiar. Maybe mm-hmm. she's relapsed. You know? So I think those are normal and understandable reactions. And it's better to broaden an understanding from pathology to saying, well, this is a reaction from trauma. And I need to learn to manage my reactions and not step in to try to do things that are unhealthy on the one hand. On the other hand, it's quite understandable why people have these reactions. And I don't think that's pathology.
This might sound a little too broad. I'm imagining like these quizzes that you take in Men's Health or Cosmo magazines or any of those crappy magazines that you can spend your 20s anyway. Flipping through.
I've been in Men's Health before.
Yeah. Oh, you have. You have been in Men's Health. Yeah.
Or my maybe physique, both my were. Physique was featured in. It was definitely worth it.
What are some signs or maybe some indicators that someone has a substance use issue, whatever it might be?
Okay. So I guess it would start with the role and the role that it plays in the person's life. So if it's working towards being what's called a kind of an organizer in the person's world and there's negative consequences starting to come back, then I think that's an indication that something's off. Doesn't mean it's addiction, just means, okay, my relationship with this substance is changing. Mm-hmm. And how do I feel about that?
Okay. That's an awesome question to ask yourself. So just as an example, I mean, I joke, but these last 2 months have been absolutely bonkers for me. And I've been on vacation. I've been moving. I have been all over the place. My wine consumption has gone up so dramatically. And the question that I might ask myself is, what is the role of this alcohol in my life right now? Right. Is that a question that, okay.
Yeah. How's it working for me? And you know, the guidelines for this sort of thing are there in place to kind of say, well, for women, and it's different for in our binary concept of gender, the guidelines for men and women are different. So with women, we're encouraging, the research is saying probably, you know, no more than one drink at a time, no more than 7 in a week. And with wine, that would mean 5 ounces. That's like 5 ounces is an alcohol equivalent of one drink.
I know my mom's listening. And so I'm just going to out her that when she pours a glass of wine, it goes all the way to the top. And I have to remind her that that's a 12 ounce glass. And
so there might be a couple of drinks plus. And
yeah, that's two glasses right there, mom, even though it fits in one wine glass.
Something like that.
Okay. So one at a time and no more than 7 a week. What is it for men?
For men, it's just so unfair. For men, it's the guidelines are saying probably, you know, no more than 2 in a drinking occasion. The official guideline, well, I'll finish that thought, and no more than 14 in a week. It is grossly unfair. But the reason is that female bodies tend to process alcohol differently. So the enzyme that breaks alcohol down is less efficient in women. There's less water typically in a woman's body than a man. So there's less dilution and the fat to muscle ratio tends to be different. So that alters metabolism. So if men and women have the same weight, same amount of food in their belly and drink the same amount of alcohol, her blood alcohol concentration will be higher. Yeah. Period. Mm-hmm. Most likely.
Okay. Okay. What might be some other questions that people can ask themselves to see if maybe maybe they might have an issue with substances?
I like thinking about it too. Sorry, Bob, to cut you off, but I like thinking about it too, not just as a, literally as a relationship. If you were in a relationship with this guy named Al and he took your money and he made you feel like shit and he made you late for work and he got in between you and your wife and sometimes he was cool to hang out with and he was nice and you enjoyed being near him, but mostly he just made you feel groggy and stupid. Would you stay in relationship with this guy? You know? And most people would say, no, I don't think I would. Right. But maybe your relationship is more familiar, right? It's like, oh, I get to see him every couple of weeks and we go out and we have a great time. We laugh a lot and come home. You know, there's just I think there's a way to personify it that sometimes can help people understand the difference between, you know, Well, just kind of where they are on that scale. If it's 1 to 10, you know, what's it like to be in relationship with this person and the consequences that come with it?
How can people reach you if they want your support, your help? How can they find you? How can they learn more about your workshops? Do you have more workshops coming up where people can come? Awesome. Well, tell our listeners about how they can get a hold of you.
Okay. So I've got three different websites that do different things. I've got drrobertnavarra.com. That's sort of the generic number of workshops I do for couples. And then I have two websites that sound the same, couplerecovery.org, which is information and resources, and a new one I plan to be launching next week, couplerecovery.com, which will be online videos for therapists and for couples. So it'll be training for therapists who want to learn about addiction and how to do assessments, and then just resources for couples of how to develop a couple recovery.
That's amazing.
Awesome. Yeah, that's really great. So those are your three websites. And then just our listeners know that we will do a virtual therapy with those that we're licensed. Do you ever meet with couples? Oh, gosh, that's an interesting question, actually. Do you ever meet with couples virtually?
Virtually, no. Well, actually, that's not true. Yes, I do. I did a marathon session with a couple recently and did a follow-up session. So marathon, I met with them for 15 hours,
right?
And then did a follow-up session online.
Mm-hmm.
And I offer actually marathon therapy and workshops out of my office. So Roadmap for the Journey is now going to be available maybe bi-monthly, limited to 3 couples.
Wow.
And just
very cool. Wow.
Santa Clara.
San Carlos. It's like Santa Clara, but it's San Carlos.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Bob.
I hope that we can generate some traffic for you, but also mostly just some good perspective for these couples out there that are asking these questions on the regular.
There's a lot of information out there that can be really, really helpful. And now that we're ending, the gardener's stopping. So we're all queued up together, apparently.
Yeah,
we are. Oh, I do have one more question, okay, Bob, before you go. So, Zach, you had mentioned the book Almost Alcoholic. We love giving resources to our couples. Do you have any books or authors or anything, I guess, other than your websites that you would recommend? If you're interested in learning more, go to this website, read this book, listen to this podcast, whatever it might be.
Well, you know, as a website that could be really full of information is the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse and Addiction or Alcoholism. It's NIAAA.
Okay.
And that sounds really techie, but really it's got really good resources, both for counselors and for couples, just to understand a lot more about alcohol. And then the National Institute for Drug Abuse is not NIDA.org. It's got something else. But if you look up National Institute for Drug Abuse, that also is another really, really good resource just to get information on different substances and resources that are available.
Yeah, cool. I've got two, which actually come from my clients who have, I've had multiple people recommend a book called Sober Curious, which is just, it's just an opportunity to kind of explore what does it mean to think about being in a, like being sober, basically sober curious. And then the other one is called The Naked Mind. It's by a woman named Annie Grace, who is really kind of the champion, at least the online champion for alcohol-free living. And so she's got a couple of books, but also an online presence that is usually supported by community and, you know, Facebook and videos and that sort of thing. So if indeed people are looking for different resources, those are a few.
Cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okie doke, guys. Thanks so much. See you next
Thanks,
time.
Thanks, Bob.
Alrighty.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Marriage Therapy Radio. In case you're interested, Bob Navarra is available. He gave you his 3 separate websites. I did want to reiterate the 3 books that were mentioned as far as Zach's perspective, but it's called The Naked Mind, Almost Alcoholic, and Sober Curious are the 3 books he recommended. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you for all of your time and attention, making your relationship better today than it was yesterday.